The 12th Annual Excellence in Partnership Awards is October 26th at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The Excellence in Partnership Awards honor those who have excelled at promoting partnership in government procurement. A special tribute to Mythbusters for those who embody effective communication between government and industry. Come celebrate at this special event for the government contracting community and the Multiple Award Schedules program. Register now for the Excellence in Partnership Awards at eipawards.com.
Save up to $1,600 on a qualifying Bryant Evolution system. Call Cool Breeze Heating and Air Conditioning at 301-879-3400. Bryant, whatever it takes.
Welcome to Your Turn. Hi, this is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us, as we are every Wednesday, and we have a good show for you today. We're going to be covering the waterfront, talking about foreign affairs, the U.S. Postal Service, and its maybe go-it-alone health plan, and then the status of the continuing resolution. First up, my guest is Susan R. Johnson. She is president of the American Foreign Service Association. Susan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
If I may call you Susan, please call me Mike.
Thank you very much.
Madam President, it gets so unwieldy there.
Absolutely, please.
Listen, I know you've got a lot on your plate. You have your board in this week, I guess this very day, and I know your father has been ill, so we wish you well on all of those. interesting time to be in the Foreign Service. What with the wars in several places, the Arab Spring, the unrest on so many places. Foreign Service is a very dangerous job, isn't it?
It's always had a danger associated with it, and I think in many respects it's been getting more dangerous, and certainly that's true today. You can just see the proportion of names inscribed on the AFSA plaque in the C Street lobby of the State Department to see that the numbers of Foreign Service officers who've died in the line of duty, been killed in the line of duty, has increased over the last several decades.
Right. Well, we had those terrorist attacks in East Africa.
Absolutely.
They lost a lot of people. The film footage the other day of the American ambassador and staff being stoned in the streets of Amman, I guess. Very risky business. Now, you sent me some talking points, and I appreciate it. One of them was there was a poll which they asked Americans what percentage of the budget of our federal budget they thought was associated with the Foreign Service, and they guessed 24%, I believe. What in fact is it?
Well, in fact, the entire international affairs budget, known as the 150 account, for both state and aid operations, as well as our entire foreign assistance budget, composes less than 1.4% of our entire federal budget.
That's a long way from 24%.
A long way from 24%.
The State Department and the diplomacy in general does not have a constituency. It does not have the political clout that a lot of lobbying groups do. I mean, you have the sugar growers and retailers and IT people and all of that. But there is not much of a lobby on Capitol Hill or even in the country for Foreign Service officers. Is that correct?
I think that's been correct, and that's been the perception, and there's some people who think that that's inevitable. I hope, and I think the members of our board today hope, that over the coming decades we can change that with the new realities of a globalized world. But I think the number one constituency that we ought to have should be the Office of the President and our Congress. Those are the people that should understand better than anyone else the importance of diplomatic readiness and for the United States to have premier diplomatic and development services to go along with the premier military service that we have.
Well, it seems like of late President Obama has Secretary Clinton, President Bush had Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. We've had some very strong, very high-profile secretaries of state. But I would think your problem is with the Congress, and particularly this Congress. It seems to be the most contentious one anybody that I know of can recall in memory. It's hard to get along with, hard to read. They're not approving budgets. Many of them seem to have an outright hostility toward the government in general, and I guess foreign operations of our government in particular.
Well, sadly, there does seem to be a, you know, heightened partisanship and a, you know, decrease in civility or rational discussion, and we hope that we'll get over that. AFSA as an organization and our members do understand very well the challenges that we're facing in terms of our debt and budget climate. And we're not opposed in principle to having foreign affairs agencies, you know, bear a fair share. But we want to stress that we fully support the president's budget request, which is based on the mission that our political leadership has given our agencies. And if the political leadership does not want to or believes that we cannot afford to fund that mission or provide the resources necessary to accomplish that mission, then I think our view is that they should look carefully at cutting back the mission and deciding what are our critical priorities today. Because there's no point to laying out a mission and then not funding it, so you set up the United States itself for failure.
I think a lot of people in the public don't really think about that. They curse the IRS for whatever it does, not knowing or not thinking that the IRS has been told to do this by Congress. They've been mandated mm-hmm. to accomplish these certain things, and then it's doubly troubling when they tell you to do something and then don't give you the money or the resources to do it.
Well, exactly, and I think that's very much the case today. When we look at the amount of resources that, you know, we feel that we need, whether it's Iraq and Afghanistan or many other parts of the world, or the amount of foreign assistance that we have traditionally been allocating to different sectors, be that in health, environment, security, counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, if we feel that we can't afford to fund the budget request that the president asked for, then I think we ought to really look at, and our political leadership needs to establish priorities there. And in all that, I think AFSA's position is that if there have to be cuts, those cuts should be made out of program. They should be in terms of redefining the mission to meet what we can afford, not out of our diplomatic readiness or our people. I think we need to, it's critical that we have the capacity to respond to both the crises and the opportunities that are likely to continue to come our way. And in all of that, I would just cite Admiral Mullen, who last year said that our diplomatic and development capabilities have a direct bearing on our ability both to shape threats and to reduce the need for military action, which of course reduces the need to spend a great deal.
When I was a copy boy at the Washington Post several thousand years ago, a lot of the kids there were waiting. They had temporary jobs at the Post, but they were either going to take the law exam, the bar, mm-hmm. or the Foreign Service test. Mm-hmm. And invariably, we had lots of parties because people would take the test and fail. It was mm-hmm. so tough. The best and the brightest seemed to pass the Foreign Service exam finally, then the law exam, and those of us who were losers remained in the newspaper business to this date. Is it still as tough as it was?
I think it's still very tough. We continue to have a very large number of people who take the Foreign Service exam every year, and a certain number who pass the written exam, and then have to go on to the other portions of it, the oral, the security clearance, the medical. And out of all that, you know, you get on a register, and then we call you, you're sort of rank ordered on that register, and you are called according to the numbers that State Department or AID, you know, need to take in. Well, State Department, AID is a different process, but that we need to take in. And that varies, of course, from year to year. And, you know, as you may know, in 2009 and 10, we had a big increase in numbers, which was part of Secretary Clinton's Diplomacy 3.0, which was built, I think, on and very consistent with her predecessor, Secretary Rice's efforts to increase the personnel and to build up after the sort of 30% loss in size and personnel in the 90s and early 2000s. So, you know, it depends. If we're taking in 1,400 people a year and we've got 2,000 on the register, then, you know, you'll have a little bit of a lucky break. But if we're only taking in 200, it's a tougher cut.
More parties for some people, clearly.
More parties for some people, yeah.
And I didn't realize that the Foreign Service was down 30% from the 1990s, and then
yes.
It's back up 17%.
It's back up now, I mean, it's really interesting to look at the size of the Foreign Service. It's a very small agency, you know, as compared to most federal agencies. So the total number of Foreign Service employees is just around 13,000, and that includes what we call generalists or Foreign Service officers and specialists. At about 7,700 generalists, officers, and 5,600 specialists. If you go back and look at 1970, you'll see that we had about 9,000 or just under 10,000. Now, of the 13,000 that we have today, 2,800 are diplomatic security, which was not the case back in 1970. And also, 1,500 or so represent people who were absorbed from the USIA, the United States Information Agency, which would have been an additional, a separate agency back then. So that would have been 10,000 plus.
So as far as diplomats go, you're in not many number gains. I'm talking with Susan Johnson. She's president of the American Foreign Service Association. And we've got to take a short break, and we'll be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2011, the new trade show featuring government audiovisual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 1st and 2nd, featuring nearly 100 leading manufacturers and solutions providers showcasing the latest in audio, video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help government agencies and the military boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. GovCom is your opportunity to see cutting-edge communications products, network with fellow technology professionals, and get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit GovCom with two M's, show.org, and use the code FED. That's govcomshow.org. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the association representing the audiovisual industry.
Remember when you tried doing something for the first time? You probably weren't very good at it. On a scale of stinko to virtuoso, chances are you were right down there. But you kept at it, and soon you went from not so hot to halfway decent. Kaiser Permanente reminds you, we all start out as beginners, stumbling over our feet, going right instead of left, swinging and missing. So whatever you're curious about, tennis or horseback riding, playing guitar or pole dancing, softball or soccer, forget about being perfect and focus on the fun. The rest will fall into place. So come on, stumblers, bumblers, listen up. It's okay to stink. Just start. Kaiser Permanente. We want you and your interests to thrive. Visit kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM every Friday morning at 11. Brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you. Call in or email questions or comments to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Fed Talk is sponsored by GEICO. This week's host, Deborah Roth, will be joined by Craig Floyd of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund to talk about its 20th anniversary and upcoming gala.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500. Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit MyVillageGreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Zymogen and Metagenics.
Hi, this is Michelle Moore, the Federal Environmental Executive. I'd like to invite you to join us at the 2011 GreenGov Symposium, co-hosted by the White House Council on Environmental Quality and the Association of Climate Change Officers, for 3 days of cutting-edge educational sessions on the business of sustainability and greening the government. Connect with more than 1,000 of your peers at this year's GreenGov from October 31st to November 2nd in Washington, D.C. For more information and to register online, visit greengov2011.org.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. It's Mike Causey. I'm talking with Susan Johnson. She is president of the American Forum Service Association, and their board is meeting today in D.C. to talk about a lot of things, including budgets and whatnot. Susan, the Army and our military, but particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, they're small. It's the smallest army we've had in a long, long time. And there's a lot of people talking about being degraded and worn down by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and people doing 2 and 3 and 4 tours. What sort of a toll, if any, is it taking on the Foreign Service?
Well, clearly these things take a toll, particularly because such a large proportion of our human resources have to be dedicated, for example, to Iraq and Afghanistan, and to partnering with our military there. And, you know, many of the same stresses that our military face, the Foreign Service faces. I mean, as you may know, the Foreign Service personnel system was based on that in the military, specifically the Navy. So we have a rank-in-person personnel system and an upper-out, closed personnel system. You take and pass an exam, you come in, then you have to work your way up within certain time periods, like the military. So, yes, it's tough. The number of unaccompanied tours that we now have is up to 1,300, which is a fivefold increase over the last, I think, 5 years or so.
That's 1,300 people that are they're in Iran or Iraq or Afghanistan.
Other dangerous places where they cannot take their family. Their family has to stay back here in the United States or somewhere else.
I guess there are a lot. What are some of those other countries? Because they don't come to mind.
Well, I mean, Pakistan, Sudan, Somalia, I mean, any place where there's sort of ongoing conflict and where it simply would be more costly and more risky to have family. And so we don't do it. But, yes, that's an added stress on both the officer as well as the family.
What about pay for people who are sent overseas? Is there a danger pay or a hardship pay?
There is danger pay. There is hardship pay. Those have both been around for a long time because danger and hardship are part of the business. For active sort of conflict zones like Iraq and Afghanistan, a decision was taken a number of years ago to increase that danger and hardship pay.
It's still not making as much as the contractors, though.
No. I saw that when I was in Iraq,
yes.
You know, up close and personal, yeah. And now it's been documented, I guess.
Now, you were stationed in Iraq, is Afghanistan and Bosnia, am I right?
Not Afghanistan. No,
not Afghanistan.
No, I was in Pakistan years ago when the Soviets were in Afghanistan and doing refugee work, but I was not in Afghanistan.
Okay.
So missed that one. But
okay.
Yes, I went to Iraq with the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, back in 2003, and I was there for 6 months as a senior advisor to the Iraqi Foreign Ministry when Jerry Bremer and General Sanchez were there.
I see Bremer in my neighborhood giant all the time.
Okay,
Say
hello to him.
I certainly will. What about, I know years ago, and I haven't heard anything about it since, but years ago and for a long time, there seemed to be a lot of tension between the career civil servants at the State Department and other foreign operations and the Foreign Service officers. It was a feeling that many of them felt they were second-class citizens. How is that going?
Well, I don't sense that much, tension at the moment. I mean, there are some inevitable systemic tensions that have existed, you know, over the decades when you have to manage an institution like the Department of State with two different personnel systems. So we've got the Foreign Service personnel system, which is based on rank and person and sort of therefore flexible and agile, and we have the Civil Service personnel system, which is the GS system. system, personnel system, with rank and position, which was established when the need for agility and flexibility and moving people around perhaps wasn't as critical as it is today. So I think the civil service are often frustrated about how to manage their career progression in the State Department, and it's just the inevitable, difficulties and differences in reconciling those two systems and managing people who work side by side on the same kinds of issues in many cases.
Has anyone in Congress given any serious thought to maybe having a different civil service system for the Foreign Service, whereby that rank in man, as opposed to rank based on how many people you supervise, would be the issue?
Well, I don't know if anyone in Congress has. People have, and that would be a great thing for them to focus on if they can, come to some agreement on some of the big framework questions. But, yes, I mean, I think to have a sort of unified diplomatic service of the United States where we would recognize that civil servants in State Department and perhaps our other foreign affairs agencies are in a particular situation, and we need a personnel system, well, first of all, preferably a single personnel system, perhaps with two streams, a domestic and a foreign, but that would make it easier for some interchangeability that's still equitable. If you pick the foreign stream, you accept a discipline of essentially rotational. You're going to spend your life, you and your family, moving every couple years wherever you need to go. That puts particular stresses, and a certain type of person likes that or can manage it. The domestic wing would be principally domestic, but with a few excursion tours, built in as requirements, so that you would have people who would have to go not only, civil servants, not only to the Londons, Parises, or wherever, Bangkoks, but also to some of what we call the hardship posts.
And right now, is that the case? I mean, can you order civil servants to go?
Well, they have civil service. There's a whole congressional authority called the 3161 authority, which came up, in the context of Iraq and Afghanistan, which employs civil people as civil servants, but sends them overseas to specific countries. And that's a whole issue in and of itself. In addition to that, in the Foreign Service, and we have long had a process whereby civil service can apply for hard-to-fill positions that remain unfilled by Foreign Service officers.
Okay.
If they choose to. But if they go, the problem is they have no guarantee of returning to the job that they had because their office can't hold it for them.
So a whole different system. Everybody, I guess, in government has some problem with the fact that Congress hasn't approved any budgets. Seems to be a way of life, and we're doing continuing resolutions, and there was some sleight of hand over the weekend. The Senate did one thing. The government, in theory, should have shut down, but it didn't. And then the House did something else on Monday. So we're good to go until a couple
November
of weeks.
18th.
November the 18th, yeah. What's that doing to the Foreign Service?
Well, I think it's doing the same as it's doing to, all the federal agencies that are affected by it, but perhaps even more so. It costs money and resources because when you're under uncertainty and ambiguity and you can't plan and you have to hold off, and so in the end it ends up costing more, sadly. It's certainly something that we regret, and I did see recently that some people have proposed that maybe Congress consider moving away from sort of the annual budget process to maybe a more multi-year one or something that would be a little more effective or allow our whole federal government to be more effective itself in carrying out the missions we're given.
I gather people in high positions are anticipating that there will be budget cuts for state and foreign service operations. If that happens, what does it mean?
Well, if the cuts are on the program side, then it means potentially a greater challenge for the U.S. to maintain our leadership and to exert political influence and to shape the kinds of threats or events. But I think we can more easily overcome that, as our economy improves, than if the cuts are made in people. takes a long time to rebuild your readiness, and I think that's what President Bush found after 9/11. Weren't enough people, so there was a big spike in the budget to get more resources, both for foreign assistance and for more people. And there was a bipartisan consensus, and all, I think, our secretaries of state from both parties have joined together in supporting, more people rebuilding state and foreign service and AID.
Well, a lot of people are worried about what this congressional bipartisan supercommittee mm-hmm. may recommend, and or if it goes to across-the-board cuts. But others say it would be even worse if they do nothing and we go into the sequestration where they just make automatically across-the-board cuts in everything without looking at programs or people.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I can't... It's a tough job, and it's a bit confusing, and how the super committee, process is going to come out and how it's going to relate to the, traditional responsibilities of the standing congressional committees, appropriations and authorizing committees. And so, yes, we're certainly, watching it as carefully as we can and hoping, and our general message is that our diplomatic readiness is critical to our national security. There's bipartisan support for that. Our secretaries of defense and many other senior defense people are, the first to recognize it. Secretary Clinton, Rice, Powell, and others have spoken out on it. So I hope that, to the extent that they feel they have to make cuts in our international affairs budget, that those come out of program, which we can more easily recover
program
from.
Program rather than people.
Program
Listen, thank you so much
people.
For giving us some time, Susan Johnson. And
okay.
Tell your people to stay safe and wish you
Well, they're the vast majority are tough and resilient and dedicated, and so we're going to, our commitment to public service remains whatever the condition.
Got you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot,
Susan
Mike.
Johnson. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Stick with us. We're going to be talking with the Federal Timesman about the Postal Service plans to set up their own health insurance system and find out what continuing resolution status is. Be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
3 things to know about the proposed merger of AT&T and T-Mobile. With the planned merger, AT&T will invest $8 billion more and deploy the next generation of wireless internet to nearly everyone in America. This investment will create as many as 96,000 American jobs. We're not investing to create jobs, but jobs will be created because we're investing. AT&T.
Tradition never graduates. Bring your family and friends to spend the day in Annapolis with Navy football. See the midshipmen take on the Southern Miss Golden Eagles Saturday, October 8th at 3:30 p.m. at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, presented by Navy Mutual Aid Association. Join us for a game day atmosphere like no other. Buy your tickets today to see Navy versus Southern Mississippi, October 8th at 3:30 p.m. Get the best seats now by calling 1-800-US-4-NAVY or by logging on to NavySports.com.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. 6 businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
This is John Gilroy from Federal Tech Talk. I've done over 200 interviews here on Federal News Radio, but many listeners still ask, yes, John, but what does your company do? Well, my company is called Armature. For the past decade, we have worked with organizations to help improve the way they collect data. You may call it comprehensive data collection, data analysis, or even outcomes measurements. If your agency has any problems with collecting, analyzing, or displaying data, then please visit our website at armaturecorp.com. We can help.
ITT Defense is becoming ITT Excellus, a new name in aerospace and defense. ITT Excellus will begin as a diversified top-tier global technology leader with the same strengths it has had for more than 50 years. Ingenuity, agility, and the ability to deliver exceptional, rapidly fielding, and affordable solutions that solve complex customer challenges across all platforms. Learn more about the future ITT Excellus at AUSA 2011 or by visiting defense.itt.com/AUSA2011.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
Cancer cells can take over your body when they evolve in ways that make them resistant to chemotherapy drugs. A new lab technique is shedding light on the process. A cancer cell's evolution to drug resistance is complex and not easily mimicked in the lab. So Bob Austin, a biophysicist at Princeton University, is using computer chip technology to make numerous microenvironments similar to a real tumor.
In this contraption I made, this complicated world, we're now growing cancer cells and we're applying gradients of chemotherapeutic agents.
Austin's work shows that can spark drug resistance, and he says a surgeon might be doing it inadvertently.
In the act of cutting out parts of the tumor and not other parts, he may be creating the same kind of world that I made, and he may actually be driving evolution forward.
Austin hopes to make 3D synthetic tumors to test his idea. More at nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. We're going to be talking with the Federal Times when Sean Riley and Steve Losey about the U.S. Postal Service plans to maybe go it alone and set up their own health system, and then we'll get the status of the continuing resolution. Steve, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for coming on. I haven't been exactly swamped with emails from people, but I have gotten a couple of concerned emails, and I think I sent you one yesterday to kind of set this up from a guy who said he'd read that the Postal Service was talking about setting up its own health plan, and he mentioned retirement system, too, I think, in his email. But how serious are they, and how would this operate? It's made a lot of people uneasy.
Yeah, the Postal Service is dead serious about this. They floated this, setting up their own health care plan, and your listener is correct. They also want to set up their own retirement plan, but that's a whole other matter. They floated this as part of a major way to kind of get its finances back in order. Basically, what they say is they want to pull out of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Plan, the FEHBP, and set up their own plan. And their plan came out back in August, and it kind of didn't go over too well. There were a lot of critics saying, how are they expecting to do this? OPM does this. They have all these people. There's the economy of scale. And when the White House came out with their postal rescue plan, they didn't address this at all. Last week, Tony Veglianti, the HR person at the Postal Service, started calling reporters around to take another crack at this, which shows to me they're not giving up on this. Basically, they want to FEHBP has more than 200 plans. They want to just with carriers such as Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, GEHA, GEHA, a whole bunch of them across the country. They want to have just one single plan with one provider. You know, maybe a few options within that plan, but only one plan. They say that's going to yield true economies of scale. Veglianti criticizes FEHBP for "quote unquote," watering down its negotiating position by dividing 8 million employees among more than 200 plans.
Well, that won't win him any friends over at OPM.
No, it's not. he doesn't have very kind words about how OPM runs the FEHBP plan.
Well, now, the Postal Service, thanks to the union contract, postal workers, active postal workers, pay much less, a smaller percentage of their premium than do white-collar federal workers. I mean, it may be, they pay maybe, they wind up paying half as much in premiums as regular federal employees. Surely, if the Postal Service went to its own health plan, that might be something they would want to revisit.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. The Vegliante claims that that postal employees' premiums wouldn't change a whole heck of a lot. Some might go up, some might go down. He says they would stay roughly in the ballpark, but he says it would result in lower costs for the Postal Service that they would put towards pre-funding retiree benefits.
Well, the idea of one plan with maybe some options in it has to make a lot of people nervous, because right now postal workers have probably, and say in the Washington area certainly, they may have 25 plans to choose from. That includes most of the national fee-for-service plans as well as a goodly number of HMOs. So from 20 or 25 to 1 would be a major change.
That's right. That's right. And that's why there are definitely a lot of people worried about this.
What are the unions saying about this?
Unions aren't too wild about this. I think they like kind of how it's been, really.
Well, and also you have the American Postal Workers Union, National Association of Letter Carriers, and the mail handlers, and the postmasters, for that matter, have their own health plans right now, and that's kind of it's not only a recruiting draw, but they also get some money from non-postal workers who pay a membership fee to belong to these health plans. So I would think that would hurt them in a place where they are making money now.
Yeah, I asked Vegliante about, you know, what would happen to, you know, the plans you mentioned, the APWU plan and so on and so forth, and it kind of sounds like they would go away. And Vegliante was kind of like, well, you know, we can't really worry about that. We got to worry about our own house.
Yeah. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think several years ago somebody, maybe you guys, reported that postal executives, that the Postal Service was paying their entire health premium.
I don't recall that off the top of my head.
Okay, seems to me there was some perk that they were getting that was even paid for, and it wasn't for the employees. So if I stand corrected, that's fine. But maybe they're not always in the game with some of these things.
Yeah.
But now, what about the retirement plan? That would seem to be even more of a sore point with employees.
Yeah, the retirement plan, basically for new employees, it would get rid of the defined benefit pension. The FERS employees now receive both TSP, a thrift savings plan, 401k type program, Social Security, and a defined benefit pension. And the Postal Service wants to, for future employees, get rid of that defined benefit pension and just stick to the 401k type defined contribution plan and Social Security. Their argument is that, which is kind of similar to what some Republicans in Congress have been saying about the entire concept of federal defined benefit plans, that it's kind of a dinosaur in the private sector. It's going away, and that they're going fast into bankruptcy. They're having serious financial disarray. They're saying, we just can't afford this.
Well, if you look at any newspaper around the country, almost daily you will see a story about the public pensions. You know, their state and local government people. They never got very good wages, but the politicians promised them good pensions down the road, maybe when they were long gone from office, and now they're rolling back these, and you're correct, the private sector is doing away with the defined benefit. So if they did this, if they went to this, and I assume Congress would have to approve it, and Congress might happily approve it given the mood they're in, people would still be able to have a thrift savings plan, and they would still be able to eligible for Social Security and pay into it. But the civil service portion of the benefit that they now get that is indexed to inflation would go away, huh?
The pension would go away. That is correct.
That's amazing.
For future employees.
Academic question here, and people are always asking me this about the newspaper business. I spent so many years with the Washington Post, loved it, and loved newspapers. I like to have one in my hand and reading it, but they say, what's the future of newspapers? What's the business plan? And as far as I know, nobody has quite figured out yet how to make money in an era when people can go online and get most of the stuff for free. What's the future for the Postal Service? I mean, can it be saved?
You know, that's the big question. I think we are still going to have a post service, but it's probably going to look very different. It's going to be, I think there's a good chance we could see something like 5-day service and perhaps getting rid of Saturday delivery or getting rid of one other day. I think it's going to still exist, but I think it's going to be drastically, its reach will be scaled back from what we see today. The post service we have today is not going to exist in the same form several years down the road.
Well, yeah, we've talked about it before, but right now, if you have UPS and FedEx and DHL and other services, and they will carry your goods for a fee, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't take something that's the equivalent of a letter-sized thing, and send it from Washington, D.C. to Anchorage, Alaska. They wouldn't do that for 44 cents,
uh-huh.
and the Postal Service does. So in a way, it's the private carriers are left to skim the cream, but the Postal Service, going back to Benjamin Franklin's days, is there as a public service.
Yeah, they have universal service. They go everywhere in the United States. There are, I believe, it's either mules or donkeys. The Postal Service, it won't. In some places in the country, uses either mules or donkeys to go down into the Grand Canyon because there are some really Native Americans who live in really remote locations, and they actually use pack animals to deliver the mail to them. They literally go everywhere in the country.
So instead of checks in the mail, it's checks on the burrow.
Exactly, yeah.
I've got to take a short break here, and we'll be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
We live in uncertain times. More than ever, federal agencies rely on TASC to accomplish the most important missions and protect America's way of life. Few in the world can do what the experts at TASC do. Trusted partners, honest counselors, TASC's highly specialized problem solvers use rare knowledge and deep experience to provide advanced systems engineering, integration, and decision support services that the U.S. government depends on to keep the country safe and secure. TASC, working for you and the nation. TASC.com.
Maritime transportation is a vital industry, contributing more than $10 billion per year to the national economy. What are the key challenges facing the maritime transportation system? How is the U.S. Maritime Administration working to enhance the competitiveness of the U.S.? Join host Michael Keegan on the next The Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and so much more with David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration.
The nation's largest intelligence event of the year returns to San Antonio, Texas, October 16th through the 19th. Network with professionals from the defense, intelligence, and homeland security communities at the GEOINT 2011 Symposium. USGIF's GEOINT Symposium features keynote speakers from agencies, combatant commands, and Congress, as well as panel sessions and breakout tracks tackling the critical issues affecting national security. Register now or learn more at GEOINT2011.com. That's GEOINT2011.com.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Department of Homeland Security is making a major move to the cloud. Homeland Security's just issued a $1.8 million contract to host many of its public-facing websites, including DHS.gov, FEMA.gov, USCIS.gov, and several others on a public cloud platform. The contract is the first issued under the General Services Administration's Infrastructure as a Service Blanket Purchase Agreement. The contract will cover all elements of website development and deployment. unit.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
And now, the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Federal hiring still takes too long and asks too much of applicants, but Office of Personnel Management Director John Berry says the agency hiring process is closer to mirroring the private sector. Officials, academics, analysts, and union representatives agree that federal agencies need to take the next steps to maintain progress. Currently, it takes 15% less time, and most job descriptions are 5 pages long or less. I'm Amy Morris.
Did you know there is a nonprofit association founded in 1943 that provides life insurance at rates far less than the federal program? This nonprofit also offers a college scholarship program and has a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million in refunds to its policyholders since 1996. The company's name is WEPA. In these challenging economic times, life insurance from WEPA allows you to save your hard-earned money. Visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Join 36,000 people from around the world, including senior leaders from the Army, DOD, and Congress, at the 2011 AUSA Annual Meeting and Exposition. This professional development forum is October 10th through the 12th at the Washington Convention Center and features exhibits on two levels and in five halls, all centered around this year's theme, America's Army, the Strength of the Nation. Admission is free but limited to qualified persons. For more information, please visit www.ausa.org.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey. We just had a nice chat with Steve Losey of the Federal Times. He told us about the shape of the U.S. Postal Service is in, and it's not very good, but very interesting, and the second largest agency in the federal government. Now we go to Sean Riley. Sean, are you with us?
I am here, Mike.
Sean, I was trying to think during the break, what sins did you commit over there that you are covering the continuing resolution on other beats?
Just luck of the draw. So it's a kind of, as you know, it's very much an ongoing story.
Well, you know, it's absolutely maddening. Something happened Friday. Something happened yesterday. And here it is, October 5th, Wednesday, at about 10:30 p.m. I see a streamer that came across the television that said the president had signed a stopgap spending bill. My head is spinning.
Well, we're good for another 6 weeks. So I think instead of talking about the fiscal year, we should start talking about the fiscal month.
Yeah.
But recent standards, this is pretty unusual. We had a four-day continuing resolution that ran from, or perhaps even three-day, that ran from October 1st to October 4th. And then yesterday, October 4th, Congress passed another CR that will run until November 18th. Who knows what will happen after that.
Well, this is government by fortnight almost.
Yes.
I don't ever recall a situation where, and this has happened for a couple of years in running, it's bipartisan, happened under the Democrats, now it's with the Republican-controlled House, is that no budgets have been approved. And it's government by continuing resolution.
That's absolutely correct. And it's becoming, CRs are nothing new. I think you have to go back quite a ways to find a year, fiscal year, in which Congress passed all dozen or so appropriations bills, annual appropriations bills, on time. But, you know, here we're in a situation where, now 5 days into the fiscal year, Congress has not passed one of the dozen appropriations bills that are needed to keep agencies going. And the Senate has only passed one. The House has passed a half dozen. But that's where we're at this point. And I think what this shows is, as nobody around here and in the government needs to be reminded, there are very stark divisions over the levels of federal spending and also various federal policies such as environmental regulation and labor policy.
Well, and when we're talking about budgets here, they're working. We're now in fiscal 2012,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
That's
but
right.
They didn't approve budgets for fiscal 2011 either, did they?
That's absolutely right. What they ended up doing was essentially they kept going on a series of short-term CRs up until mid-April, and then on the very precipice of a government shutdown, they passed a CR that covered the rest of the fiscal year. And now we're back. Now we're into FY12, and we've got an additional complication in that under the debt ceiling legislation that was passed back in August. We've got this Congressional Super Committee, which is supposed to report by November 23rd, just 5 days after the current CR expires. And so chances are no one in Congress is going to want to pass a full-year appropriations bill or bills before that that Super Committee reports. So chances are pretty good that, you know, with a possible exception of maybe the Defense Department, the Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs funding bills, most of the government will be under CR at least through Christmas.
Well, and some people, they say the only thing worse than the Super Committee coming out with various recommendations to cut things would be if it does nothing or if Congress rejects it.
Yeah, well, then in that case, we have a process known as sequestration. This goes back to the late 80s, early 90s, under which you would then, at least in theory, see across-the-board cuts to federal agencies starting at the beginning of 2013. Now, the one saving, you know, two saving graces here. One is, you know, there would be about a year or so delay in this process. And two, of course, what Congress created, Congress can uncreate. And there's, I think, at least a reasonable possibility that rather than let these across-the-board cuts take effect, you know, half of which would fall on the Defense Department, Congress might go back and revisit some of what it enacted back in August.
Well, this super committee, bipartisan, bicameral, House, mm-hmm. Senate, Republicans, Democrats, six of each, they have an executive director, they have a staff. What's leaking out of there, if anything?
Very little, and I think that's, you know, in part that's because they are meeting in secret. They're almost by definition, they're going to have to deal with sensitive issues such as tax policy, spending cuts, et cetera. But also, I think the other reading is that they're having a hard time agreeing on anything. You know, Republicans have been quite adamant. They do not want to see any type of overall increase in tax rates, although some may be open to closing some tax loopholes. And where you have other members on the Democratic side who are adamantly opposed to cutting any, major spending cuts without some kind of increase on the revenue side.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're going into this to make a compromise, and yet both the Democrats and the Republicans have each said what they're right off the bat what they're not going to do. They won't accept, won't listen to. So
yeah, and it's
subject
to
change.
Yeah, it's hard to see how you're going to come up with a compromise out of those positions.
Yeah, well, when they went in, but some of the ingredients we know they may be looking at were an amalgam of things that came out of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, mm-hmm. appointed by the president, which made some recommendations. Nothing happened. Then you had the Republican budget with some proposals. Nothing so far has happened on that. Then you had one other group, it escapes me now, that got together to do something and wound up doing nothing.
They all kind of run together, don't they?
They do. They seem to be, they ought to put the same people on them. It would save a lot of time. But the bottom line is, while they haven't done anything, they floated a number of ideas out there, everything from going from the high three to the high five and the retirement calculation, to the one we were talking earlier with Steve about eliminating the defined benefit for future hires, making federal workers pay more for their retirement, and that recommendation actually came out of the White House. It was not as draconian as some people had feared, but it's still out there, certainly in play. And talk about having the government pay a smaller percentage of the health insurance premium, and it would get smaller each year.
Yes, and I think there's a pretty good chance, given particularly on the high three to high five, or other pension changes, that, you know, something like that, there will be something like that will be ultimately enacted. It's just, you know, it's low-hanging fruit. And interestingly, Jack Lew, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, spoke a week or so ago at a Partnership for Public Service forum, and he was asked about, whether federal employees could expect to see more pain, basically, in terms of impact on pay and benefits, and he did not rule that out.
Well, and they were talking too about when these retirement changes that they wouldn't kick in until 2013, when presumably federal workers will start getting pay raises again.
Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't count on that. I mean, I think there's going to be, you know, in terms of pay, that's in, I wouldn't count on this. If I were a federal employee, I wouldn't necessarily count on getting a pay raise increase in base pay in 2013. I think there'll be continuing pressure to keep down, keep down compensation costs as much as possible, and that's certainly an easy target. Although, well, obviously, no one knows exactly what will happen.
Well, yeah, that's an easy way to do it, and the process takes some time. The BLS has to look at the numbers, and then they come up with the pay agents come up with a figure which people always ignore, but at least it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final decision is made not based on inflation, cost of living, or anything else, but it's a fiscal, F-I-S-C-A-L. It's a fiscal and a political decision, and that they could spend so much time doing that there would not be a pay raise by default.
Mm-hmm. Right, and of course, if we're we're in a CR situation, if these long-term CRs continue, that's going to be another factor holding down. Another factor in terms of trying to limit compensation. And actually, that's one, oddly enough, I think that's one side benefit for agencies who are now trying to work under CRs. They don't have to deal with, the impact of a pay raise. At the same time, they're trying to essentially manage on the same money. And actually, in this case, a little